Well, good morning. Well, we're wrapping up Genesis today, and we are in Genesis chapter 49. Genesis chapter 49. I want to just close out the book and then just talk a little bit on the whole about the book of Genesis, and also just inform you what the process is on my end from here going out with these notes. So Genesis 49, we're in the middle of Jacob giving his prophetic word, and it's a prophecy that he gives. We're in the middle of Jacob giving his prophecy to his sons before he dies. So as he gathers his sons together, we're told in verse number 1, Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days," or in the days to come. Can't remember the ESV, is it days to come, something like that, or latter days, some translations. But the specific phrase there, last days, is actually, I think, the best translation of that. That's the way the New King James translates it. That phrase, last days, is a really specific phrase that refers in every other case in the Old Testament to prophecy. That's what it always refers to. So in the original Hebrew, that's what's going on. And so the original readers would have been clued in. Jacob is uttering prophetic imagery. And he goes down through his sons, commenting on each one of them. We noted a little bit of this already. Reuben, even though he was the firstborn, is set aside in terms of receiving the double blessing that would have been normal for the firstborn because of his sin with Jacob's concubine. So he references that in verse 4, "Unstable in his water, you shall not excel. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." Simeon, Levi, sons 2 and 3, are also not given blessing here much at all. They're described as instruments of cruelty. These are the ones who went through and slaughtered the men of Shechem in response to what had happened to their sister. Their wrath, verse 7, is cruel. "I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." And we noted that that's what happened, that they did not receive a land allotment like the rest of the brothers. Simeon is basically subsumed under Judah. Levi, though he was the priestly tribe, was never granted land. They were granted a few cities, but they were not granted land. And then we left off looking at Judah. Judah is now functioning in some sense here, kind of like the firstborn, even though Joseph gets the double blessing. Judah, it's clear, is going to become the leader of the people. There's kingly imagery that is used to describe Judah. We also get for the first time in verse 9 the idea of Judah and its tribe being associated with a lion. Remember Revelation, the Lion of Judah? We have that kind of imagery that shows up here. And you have the promise that all of the people, all of the people of Israel are going to bow down before him. And furthermore, not just the people of Israel, if you go to the end of verse number 10, "Unto him shall be the obedience of the people." And in most translations, it's better translated as peoples. The peoples of the earth are going to come before a descendant of Judah. We also noted in verses 11 and 12 that you see that when he comes to reign, when his descendant comes to reign as is promised, the prosperity that will be brought to the peoples of the earth will be unparalleled. And that's the picture of when you bind a donkey to the vine. That's a grapevine. You would never do that. Donkeys eat everything. You would never, ever do that to your grapevine. Grapevines were very expensive. It took a long time to grow. And the wine that would come from that was precious. And so the fact that when he comes, his descendant would come to reign, and there would be that kind of prosperity that you could just tie your donkey to the vine and it wouldn't matter. Maybe we might think of it as you decide to, for your kid's playroom, fill it with $100 bills that they can swim in, right? I mean, it's just like, you would never do that. You would never do that, right? Unless you had that immensity of wealth. So this is the promise of when the descendant of Judah, who ultimately will be the Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ. Same thing in verse 12. "His eyes are darker than wine. His teeth are whiter than milk. That's a picture of richness. And I missed the second half, verse 11. His clothes are in the blood of grapes. They washed his garments in wine. You would never do that. That was a very expensive picture. So that's where we left off with these blessings going down through the sons of Joseph. Well, we pick it up. The rest of the sons, the next few sons, very very little is said about them. They're much shorter in their description. The two longest descriptions of the prophetic word that Jacob gives regarding his sons comes for Joseph and it comes for Judah. But we do get some other pictures here. You have in verse 13, Zebulun. He's going to be a near the sea, and that is ultimately where his land was allotted. Issachar in verse 14 will have good agricultural land. Some people think that at the end of verse 15 that it says that he bowed to shoulder and bear a burden and he became a band of slaves, indicate that he will be subjugated to forced labor. But actually, I think it's probably better understood that he will be a reliable laborer, not that he will actually be a slave, but he'll be reliable. But Bible commentators debate on that issue. Dan, he's going to be a judge. He will have the position of being a judge. Gad will often be attacked, but he will be a strong tribe and will defeat many enemies. You have in verse number 20, Asher is going to receive some of the best agricultural land, and as a result, he'll be able to produce a whole lot of great things for people to eat. Naphtali would be known for beautiful words, poetry, music, the arts, things of that nature. And then Joseph, in verses 22 and following, he gets a whole lot of attention here in this. And Joseph will be particularly blessed and helped by the Lord to become a shepherd and a flock. And remember that Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, were the ones who would receive the tribal allotment. Because Joseph functionally became the one who received the double blessing from Jacob. And so his two sons were adopted formally by Jacob in order to receive the blessing. And so Joseph's sons of Ephraim and Manasseh would produce some of the largest tribes in Israel. The idea where it says there that he's a fruitful bough by a well, his branches run over the wall. The idea that these sons are going to have expansive growth, and Ephraim and Manasseh certainly had all of that. And then finally, at the end, we see in verse 27, Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, will be a warrior, devouring the prey. And that was often true of Benjamin over its history. Now, at the end of these blessings, and they're worth exploring more in detail, you can do that on your own time. But Jacob repeats to the whole clan, as he had done earlier to Joseph, that he wants that his bones, that he would be buried in Israel. And he names specifically the place he wants to be buried. He wants to be in the field of Ephron, the Hittite, the cave. That's the one that Abraham bought, where Abraham and Sarah and Isaac is buried. And he says, I want to be buried there as well. And having put his house in order, we note that he dies, verse 33. And when Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed, breathed his last, and gathered to his people. We should not think that literally he got done and saying his last words and he curled up and died, like, you know, 30 seconds later. That's probably not the imagery that you should gather, but rather he had put his house in order and now he was ready to die, and he did. So that's the end of Jacob in the account. Well, that leaves in chapter 50 now Joseph and all of the brothers. And Joseph is still functionally the most powerful man on planet Earth, though that technically belonged to Pharaoh. Joseph was the one who was running all of Pharaoh's affairs. And so we read what happens at the end of the book of Genesis in Genesis 50, first of all, by noting Jacob's burial in verses 1 through 14. Joseph falls over his father's face in verse 1. He weeps over him. He kisses him. These were normal signs of mourning in the ancient Near East and certainly that of Israel. Joseph also commanded that his father be embalmed according to the normal practice of the Egyptians. And so they embalmed Israel at the end of verse 2. Remember, Israel was also Jacob's name given by God. So they go through this process, and then we read in verse 3 that 40 days were required for him, for such are the days for those who are embalmed, and the Egyptians mourned him for 70 days, probably 70 total. That lengthy 70-day mourning period for the death of Jacob indicates how much the Egyptians revered Joseph and his family. Indicates how much they revered Joseph and his family. Diodorus, who's an ancient Greek historian, says that the Egyptians would mourn a pharaoh for 72 days. So this should give some perspective that this was a great sign of honor for not only Joseph, but also the entirety of his family. Now, assuming that's true, and Diodorus is still roughly 1600 years removed from the time period of the Egyptians here in Genesis chapter 50. But assuming that it's true, Jacob was granted, therefore, a very high status. And that had to have been surprising for the people of Israel, because remember, the first people who are receiving these books are the people who have just got kicked out of Egypt or had to flee Egypt. And this would remind them that, no, this wasn't always this way, that God had purposes and plans and seasons for his people. So there would have been a shock to that, but also probably an encouragement. And the Lord has taken care of us in various ways over time. Early on, it was with the blessing of protection and provision and security while the famine was all over the known world. And even now, as we flee from Egypt, we are blessed in that we receive great care by God in going into our promised land. Also, Pharaoh grants Joseph's request for him to go up and bury Jacob back in Canaan, and the fact that Pharaoh would grant that request also indicates that Pharaoh regarded Jacob and Joseph highly. And you just think about that. They're in the midst of this famine that is wreaking havoc on the earth, and you have your top executive who's saying, I am going to go take this trip. That's not a short trip. You know, that's not just like, hey, I'll be on a plane, you know, go catch my father's funeral and I'll be back, you know, in 2 days, right? And by the way, I can, you know, you can reach me at any time on my cell phone, right? That's just not the way that it would work in that time period. This was a significant investment and a significant trip. And Joseph and his brothers, you see this in verse 8, his father, all of his father's house, their little ones, their flocks, you know, that there's a whole lot going on. They go up with chariots and horsemen. It was, in verse 9, a very great gathering. Incredible. And this also probably for the people of Israel who first received this is a little bit of a foreshadow of their also leaving Egypt as well. Okay, we've left before, and God took care of us then, and we can leave again. God will continue to take care of us. Well, essentially, our last most significant scenes occur in the last few verses here of Genesis, leading up to Exodus, and that is of Joseph's forgiveness, and then the death of Joseph. We read in verse number 15. That Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, and they are really concerned at this point. They say, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him. Right? So, you know, they've been now in Egypt for quite a few years, and thus far, God has, through Joseph, spared their lives, but Dad's gone now, you know. And maybe now that he's gone, it's like they're thinking Joseph has this whole time been waiting for Dad to die, and now, you know, they're all going to be dead, or their lives are going to be made miserable. And so they're very afraid of this. And in some sense, on a human level, we would go, yeah, that I'd be afraid of that too, right? You know, there was a serious crime that they inflicted upon Joseph. And yet, Joseph doesn't take out his revenge. Instead, what happens is, in verse 16, they send messengers to Joseph. They're afraid to even appear before his presence. And they remind Joseph of everything that their dad said, saying, verse 17, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers. So, end of verse 17, please forgive the trespass of your servants. Also interesting how they say that. Not brothers, but servants. We'll do anything, Joseph. We see that this stings a whole lot at the end of verse 17. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. So here the messengers come. It's not even the brothers. It's the messengers who come, and Joseph weeps when they speak these words to him. And we see why he weeps, because Joseph, in his heart, it becomes very obvious, had already forgiven them of these trespasses. So then his brothers, in verse 18, also went and fell down before his face. So you see that the messenger there, so they're terrified even to come into his presence. And you got to think about that. They've just made, relatively recently, a long journey together all the way to that cave where they buried dad, and they've journeyed all the way back. And that whole time, you know, they're anxious about this, and they can't even go, even though they spent all that time with Joseph, they can't even go to his presence. They got to send messengers there. And finally, they get in their presence. Behold, verse 18, we're your servants. Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. This text gives us great lessons on the nature of forgiveness. Joseph was not in the place of God, and neither are we. God is the one who will enact justice and vengeance. Neither Joseph or we are to enact it. And considering the serious sin that was against Joseph by the brother, this forgiveness is a powerful reminder that we too can offer forgiveness even when we are sinned against greatly. It's an amazing thing. I should also add here too, and we noted this at the front end of this whole account of Joseph, this section just drives home the theme of God's providence and his ability to use even evil things to bring about his glory and good. So verse number 20 is one of the most important statements in the Bible of God's providence as it relates to even evil things. Okay? So, but as for you, you meant evil against me. And we need to be really specific about what that is. That includes the casting of Joseph into a pit, selling him into slavery, where presumably he would die as a very young man. That's what usually happened to slaves. And it included lying to their now dead father and saying that he was killed by an animal. There are more evil things in the world, but it's really hard to come up with one that's worse than this against your own brothers. Okay? So, not, you know, we can try to play a game of saying which is the greatest, you know, most wicked thing that's ever been done in the history of the humanity. I don't know, but I'll just say that this type of thing has to rank up there pretty high, right? So, but as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it. And you have to ask, what's the it? It's the act of putting Jacob or Joseph into that pit, selling him as a slave. God meant it for good. And then we even get a purpose statement as to what this good accomplishes. In order to bring about it as it is this day, to save many people alive. And how that works out in the mind of God, that he can take an evil action that he himself didn't do, but actually intend and purpose it for something good, is way beyond me. I have enough hard time managing my day, much less managing an entire scope of world population like this. But God did that. So that should ruminate in our mind about God's divine providence and his sovereignty over the affairs of men and how he uses even horrible things in our lives to bring about good. And Joseph's words, he speaks kindness to them. Don't be afraid. He repeats that again in verse 22. Don't be afraid. I'll provide for you and your little ones. And I just love this at the end. This is a beautiful picture. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. And here you have the full reunion of a broken family that has now been united again. That's incredible, considering all that has happened. So there's so many lessons for us. I'll just say that, you know, if you think about any broken relationship that you have experienced or are experiencing, I would just say this story should remind you not that it will be fixed. There's no guarantee of that. But this story should remind you that it can be fixed. It can be fixed. And that's just a beautiful thing, encouraging to my heart. Then we conclude with the death of Joseph, the death of Joseph. Joseph, he dwells in Egypt. He had his father's household. He lives 110 years, verse 22. He lives long enough to see Ephraim, that's his son's children, to the third generation. So that's great. You know, you got son, grandson, great-grandson, great-great-grandchildren. He got to see. Pretty incredible. He lives 110 years, and he mentions some of the children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. And Joseph, like that of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, he says to his brethren, I'm dying. And you have these just beautiful words of promise. I'm dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put into a coffin. And what happens, if you know the rest of the story, what happens to Joseph's bones when the children of Israel leave Egypt? They take them with. They fulfill this oath that was made for them. Now, it's important to understand that by ending the book with the promise of a return to the land, Moses makes Genesis in some ways an eschatological book. Now, that's a big word. Some of you know what that means. Probably many of you do. Eschatological. That's a way of talking about eschatology or future things. And we often think when we read the Bible, if we think about future things, what's the number one book of the Bible that people think about when they think about future things? It's Revelation, right? You know, and we're thinking about things like timing of the rapture, the millennium, future eternal state, last judgment, all of those things. So we might think of those kinds of things, right? So future realities that way. I would actually make the contention that the entire Bible is an eschatological book. It's always pointing us to the future promises of God. Now, in the case of Genesis, many of the things that were promised have already come to pass, such as the granting of land to the people of Israel, at least in part, that's happened. But from the perspective of the first readers, as they were reading this, they were seeing that God was making promises to them. Now, there are some promises in the book of Genesis that are yet to be fulfilled, such as we saw in Genesis 49, the promise of Judah and one of his descendants reigning in such a way that all the peoples of the earth are brought under obedience underneath him. Now, newsflash, if you look at the newspaper, you watch whatever your favorite cable news network is, just this week, you figured out that has not yet happened. That's not yet happened. So there are future things. But the Bible, one of its consistent themes is that it is always pointing us to the future hope of God's promises. And that's designed. It's designed that way to get us to think that God has intended blessings that are yet to come. In this sense, we live out what the book of Hebrews would say to us, that we live by faith. Like Abraham, we look for a city whose builder and maker is not made with hands, but it's from God. like the people of Israel, we look forward to the freedom from the bondage of Egypt to the promised land. We're always looking forward. And in Christ today, I can think of several great promises. I am looking for the full redemption of my body. I am looking forward to a restored time of peace on earth. I'm looking forward to God dwelling with his people again. So Genesis is a book about the future as much as it is a book about the past. And it's funny if you think about it that way. The beginning of Genesis starts with, in the beginning. And we think about past. But the end of the book is pointing us to the future. So the book is not just a book of history. It's also a book that points us forward to God's redemptive purposes. So when you read the Bible, and sometimes we need to have both of those things in our mind. And that's especially true in a book like Genesis. And I don't think it's an accident that Moses, in the first scroll of the five scrolls, remember talking the Pentateuch, that he starts out his book, starts out those five scrolls this way. In the beginning, history, but we're looking forward to future. It's a perfect beginning, not only to the Pentateuch, it's actually a perfect beginning to the whole Bible. All right? God has done things, but he has plans yet for his people. So in this sense, I think the book of Genesis is just a beautiful book. We've gotten into the nitty-gritty, and we've taken a long time, probably too long, to go all the way through this book. We haven't hit everything, but we've taken a long time. But if you begin to see that arc that way throughout the book, you'll discover that Genesis is not only a beautifully inspired book of God, it's a literary masterpiece. It is a well-thought-out, constructed book that Moses has given under the inspiration of God that points the affections of God's people towards God's promises in the future. So much in Genesis to see, to enjoy, and I hope it's been a blessing to you. Questions? And then I've got just a few remarks that I want to make about Genesis, and we'll be done.
Fascinating little bit of history. There was an Austrian archaeologist by the name of Manfred Bitek who went to the city of Ramses within, and he discovered that there was actually a city below. They usually would build the cities on top. There was actually a city below that before the city of Ramses had been built, known as Abaris, and they actually found a location where there were 12 different tombs. One of them was actually a pyramid shape. They found that the person who was supposed to be buried there was actually Asiatic or Jewish, and had distinctive markings on the statue that was inside there of a Jewish person at that time, oddly enough, wearing a multicolored coat. And the weirdest thing is, there were no bones there.
Yeah, that's a true story. So whether that is certainly Joseph's tomb, you can't be 100% certain, but I'm actually pretty close to it on that. There is good archaeological evidence even to suggest that these things happen. Let me just say a couple of things going forward. I just appreciate you letting me go a long time. When did we start it? We started this in, was it December, I think?
1987.
Yeah, right, yeah. it's been long. Our intention is not to take this long in most of our Sunday school series, but this is a little bit different since trying to reconstruct some notes for the pastoral enrichment program. So I appreciate you letting me teach through these things and write some of these things and rewrite, and a lot of this is completely new as well. And that's been a huge help to me. Process going forward for me for as far as these go for the notes for the pastoral enrichment program. The first thing I'm going to do is go through and just do an edit for myself. I'm going to go through. There's some mistakes that we've already caught. I'll find some more. There's some parts, too, I kind of want to reconstruct after teaching all the way through the book, going, I think I should bring this up here instead of there, or vice versa, or add a little section here and there. So that'll be kind of the goal for me to do over the next couple of months. Maybe sooner. We'll see how my time lays out. From that point, I would actually love, and if you are interested in this, for a couple of people who would be willing to take my edit and actually read all the way through that and do some finely attuned grammar work, and also looking for even the stuff of like looking up all the references to make sure that I've actually got the right reference with the verse, you know, the concept that I have. If you are interested in helping me with that, I would love another set of eyes. And so if that's your thing, now if you can't spell worth anything and, you know, you barely pass sixth grade English class, this might not be your job, okay? But if that's something that you're halfway decent at, I would love a couple of people to be able to do that. Then from there, I will actually go through a third edit where I'm going to try and convert these as much as possible to be easily translated into multiple languages. So what that means is I have to go and use the, if you're a grammar person, you know what this means. You have to use the active voice as much as possible, not the passive. You have to make sure that the sentence structure is as short as it possibly can be, even if it flows really well in English, to make sure that it's easy to translate for a translator to other languages. So then there'll be a third edit of that, and then from there I'll pass that on to Scott Willequit, and he'll pass it on to a team of people at the Pastoral Enrichment Program who'll go through it and say, oh yeah, this works, or we need to change this, that, or the other. And then it'll be submitted to start being used for classes in Africa and Latin America and India and Pakistan and all kinds of places. So that's kind of the goal. Originally, I told Brother Willquit that I would have this done sometime in 2026. He was actually pushing me to get it done by the end of this month. And so because I'm hopefully going to be teaching with him in Ghana, he wanted to teach Genesis. And I said, I just don't think that's going to get done. I value my sleep and family. So it's not going to happen. But so hopefully towards the end of this year, we'll get that process finished and then sent off. And then you all will be a part of that as a ministry, not only in our church, but also a ministry in other parts of the globe for hopefully material to be used for a decade or more to teach pastors and church leaders across the globe about how to rightly interpret Genesis. So I thank you very much for being part of that process. It really is special to me. You got questions about that? Somebody did ask me, do you get paid for this? No, people in Africa don't have money, so they we don't get paid for it. That's not the point. So just hope to be a blessing.
I did notice one thing, though, as we're going through these, that all of the children are all mentioned in various ways, and they all get certain blessings. But when you come to that last verse that you were talking about, of 23, where he says the children of, how do you pronounce it, Masher?
Mashir?
I don't know. The son of Manasseh, who were brought up also on Joseph's knees. They have a reference way over in Numbers in 32, 39. Says, the children of Mashir, the son of Manasseh, went to Gilead and took it and disposed the Amorites who were in it. But they're the only ones that they are mentioned anywhere else, specifically by that guy's name, of all these other people.
That's interesting. Yeah.
For what it's worth.
Yeah. But that shows up in the Pentateuch. It's in Numbers, right?
Yeah.
That's probably, I did not make that connection. That's probably an intended reference by Moses then.
For something, yeah.
Good. All right, well, for a change, we're a couple of minutes early, of which nobody has ever complained for a speaker being done early. So enjoy a few extra minutes of fellowship, and we'll see you later for the morning worship service.